I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE. In a week when Russian nuclear submarines docked in Havana, today is the final day for G7 leaders in Puglia, Italy, arming genocide in Gaza and targeting Russia with missiles. It follows BRICS foreign ministers, including the UAE's Sheikh Abdullah bin Zayed Al Nahyan, meeting in Russia to chart a new multipolar world away from the catastrophic NATO nation rules-based order. Joe Biden, though, will be in LA with the butcher of Libya, Barack Obama, and celebrities George Clooney and Julia Roberts to finance his election campaign. Even he refused to go to Switzerland today, hosting a bizarre Ukraine peace conference where Russia is banned from attending. Zelensky, who has outlawed democracy, and UK PM Rishi Sunak, never elected by the popular vote to be PM in Britain, will be there, though, apparently. In these dangerous times, when nuclear war has arguably never been nearer, I'm joined from New York by a former advisor to successive UN Secretaries General. Professor Jeffrey Sachs is director of the Center for Sustainable Development at Columbia University and president of the UN Sustainable Development Solutions Network. He has served as a special advisor to UN Secretaries General Kofi Annan, Ban Ki-moon and Antonio Guterres. Thank you so much, Professor Sachs, for coming on. You've been tireless in your work trying to alert the world for the need for negotiations on Ukraine and Gaza. I suppose I have to ask you, given you're a former advisor to so many governments, why you're not more on so-called mainstream media? You're on some kind of blacklist? You're not needed, your voice, these journalists think?
Well, in the United States, the word negotiation became a dirty word. So they don't want to hear much about this, and they don't want to admit that it's the United States' utter failure of diplomacy that is the real story of the continuation of the Ukraine war. So it's a little bit hard to get through on these essentially government-mediated media in the U.S. They're not owned by the U.S. government, but they seem to depend on the official narrative as their guidepost. And most of the American people don't trust this. They are not in favor of the foreign policy that Biden has been pursuing. They want to change. And so they're hearing it, even if it's not on the mainstream channels.
Yeah, I mean, we, to name drop, I was on the phone to Seymour Hersh the other day, and actually Cy came on this show after his piece about the Nord Stream pipeline supplying energy to Germany, which was bombed. And Going Underground producers have tracked down. You were on Bloomberg on October the 3rd in 2022, and the presenter, Tom Keane, interrupted you, seeming outraged, saying, "Jeff, we've got to stop there," when you suggested that the United States could have been involved. And that was before Seymour Hersh's piece. And you said, "I know this runs counter to our narrative, and you're not allowed to say these things in the West." Was that
interestingly, you know, when I've spoken to some leading journalists, of course, they agree with me privately, but publicly their papers or the media say just the opposite. So narrative is a game, but a very deadly one and a very stupid one in a lot of ways. So much of what we hear day to day is just lies. It's just manipulation. It doesn't even really pass for the truth, but it passes time so that our government officials have something to say, even when they're doing outrageous things.
I mean, in terms of scale, even higher than Gaza and Ukraine, COVID was a huge story. You were on the Lancet COVID Commission, the Lancet, the preeminent scholarly journal in Britain and medical journal. You maintain that COVID and biowarfare were related as regards the laboratory there. Obviously, a story that we can't even talk about here if we want to be on
social
media.
It's a very strange thing. The pandemic claimed around 20 million lives. There are very good reasons to believe that the virus came out of laboratory work, paid for, funded, brainstormed by the U.S., and having a serious discussion about it has been extraordinarily difficult. You can imagine why the U.S. government doesn't want an open investigation. But what is surprising to me is how few supposedly independent investigators and journalists have cared to look into this. And even the scientists have done a miserable job, scientific community, policing its own community, because this was a scientific venture, albeit one led by the U.S. government. And the scientific community has not asked hard questions. Let me just say, the origins of SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID, is still unknown. I would put it at most likely, I would say overwhelmingly likely, that it came out of laboratory research rather than out of nature, as has been told to us. But we still don't know for sure. But what I can tell you is that there's been a lot of fake news about this, that it surely came out of the marketplace and so forth. And this is deception, not an honest inquiry.
The marketplace in China, but of course there was a U.S. lab
yes,
there.
That's right.
Well, let's get on then to this final day of the G7 in Puglia, seven countries whose corporations are literally making a killing out of what is going on in Gaza. I mean, do you think there's a case for saying the G stands for genocide after what you've been watching and saying these past 8 months in the latest round of violence that's been happening for decades in West Asia, in Palestine?
The G7 countries, but mainly the United States, which is the leader of the G7, grew into a lot of arrogance over the years, believing they could do what they want, say what they want, win where they would want to win, and so on. This has gotten the world into three massive geopolitical crises right now. Of course, Ukraine, complete disaster for Ukraine itself, first and foremost, but also for Europe and the rest of the world. The devastating war, a genocidal war by Israel in Gaza, and tensions that are at the edge of exploding into open war in East Asia and especially over Taiwan. The U.S. is, to my mind, an irresponsible actor in all three of these events. When it comes to Ukraine, the irresponsibility is that this war could easily have been avoided, and I really mean easily, by NATO, that means the U.S., declaring clearly NATO will not expand to Ukraine. This was a promise given to the Soviet and Russian leaders back in the early 1990s that NATO wouldn't move one inch eastward, and then NATO has moved or tried to move relentlessly eastward.
Sorry to interrupt Russia's you, Professor, but you know that the so-called journalists, some would say stenographers, are repeating this word unprovoked when it comes to Russia moving to save the ethnic Russians in the East. What do you just flinch every time you hear this phrase, unprovoked, which is used by...
I don't flinch. I laugh. Yes, I do cringe a little bit because, first of all, this is a provoked war. Second, the word unprovoked is provoked in the sense that it is part of the talking points of all of these reporters. They wouldn't even come up with the same word, same exact word, repeated endlessly, were it not so phony. So this is a war that had many provocations. It was a war that could easily have been avoided. When I say many provocations, it goes back to the U.S. plan to expand NATO to Ukraine and Georgia back to the 1990s to Zbigniew Brzezinski, contrary to promises that were made at the end of what we thought was the end of the Cold War, I should say. The unilateral U.S. withdrawal from the ABM Treaty in 2002, the 78 days of bombing of Belgrade by the United States and its allies in 1999 to break that country apart and install a NATO military base in Kosovo, carved out from Serbia, the overthrow of Viktor Yanukovych in February 2014, where Victoria Nuland, the Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs at the time, was point person for this, and absolutely in collaboration on regime change. The absolute failure of the U.S., Germany, and France to abide by, defend, and insist on the implementation of the Minsk II agreements. Provoked? Of course it was provoked. Wars don't come out of nowhere. And anyone watching the history of this has seen these provocations all along. And a point that I keep making is that at the end of 2021, this was already 9 years into conflict, which started with the overthrow of Yanukovych by the United States and right-wing forces in Ukraine. 9 years later, the big war could have been avoided and the fighting could have stopped when Russia put on the table a revised U.S.-Russia security arrangement based on Ukraine's neutrality, on the non-enlargement of NATO. And I told the White House then, take it, negotiate. Of course, there are
you phone them up.
Don't agree, but negotiate.
I mean, did you speak to the State Department?
I spoke to the White House, and I said, don't have a war over this. This is obviously avoidable.
You see, I know you're saying it's obvious, and Ban Ki-moon has been on this show. People can watch our interview with him, and he certainly said things that he might not have said when he was Secretary General, but you were advisor to Secretary Generals. Secretaries General, apparently, is the grammatically correct way to talk
That's
about
correct.
Them. if you say this is so obvious, does Antonio Guterres not know that it's that obvious? Because I think he may have used the word unprovoked at one stage or other.
I think that leaders around the world know that this is a proxy war. I'm not going to put words in anybody's mouth, least of all a Secretary General, but I speak to leaders all over the world, and I can tell you there is a widespread feeling, very widespread, that this is a proxy war between the U.S. and Russia, that the NATO enlargement is a key part of it, and that it should stop now with negotiations, and that Ukraine is the first and foremost victim of all of this refusal on the Western side to negotiate.
And the Swiss conference, Switzerland no longer neutral, arguably?
Well, the Swiss conference was shambolic to begin with, and it's shambolic all the way through. It is meaningless. It was a show. It's sad. It's sad to see Switzerland be used this way. It really is sad to see Switzerland used this way.
Professor Sachs, I'll stop
you. And allow itself to be used this way.
Professor Sachs, I'll stop you there. More from Columbia University's director of the Center for Sustainable Development after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with Professor Jeffrey Sachs, president of the United Nations Sustainable Development Solutions Network. Professor, you were talking about how the Swiss conference today doesn't mean much. Obviously, Russia's not invited in to it. You're supporting Jill Stein, I understand. How, for the US presidency, presidential elections, it looks like Trump, many of the polls are saying, will there be any difference when it comes to Gaza specifically? Or will there definitely be some change on Ukraine? Or is it very difficult to tell based on the pronouncements from Trump and their backers? We should say that there are prominent Israeli lobbyists backing for Biden and for Trump.
Look, my advice to the rest of the world, which is 95.9% of the world, because the U.S. is 4.1% of the world population, is be serious, be consequent, insist on truth, hang together, and don't expect any miracles, even stability necessarily, from the United States. The U.S. is going to be unstable and unpredictable after November, no matter what happens. Neither of the two lead candidates is a candidate for peace. They each have their own different modes of behavior, but neither is going to bring the kind of reasoned, peaceful approach to the world that we urgently need. It's going to have to come from the rest of the world that says, look, you're a big and powerful country, but you cannot run roughshod over the world. The U.S. will bluster, will say, we'll leave the UN, we'll leave this agency, we'll leave this, we'll walk out of this treaty. It may do many things, but the rest of the world is a much, much bigger part of humanity. By acting wisely, judiciously, operating under the UN Charter, abiding by treaties, being patient with the U.S., please give it time to get back to normal. I think that this is the best approach.
Because for all the optimism at BRICS conferences, the recent one, there's one coming up in Kazan, if you are a world leader and you do advise some of them, presumably you give that advice to them, what are you supposed to do when you're threatened by people from the State Department or some of the other agencies of the United States when you refuse to obey U.S. policy, whether it be a threat to your currency, whether it be to media attacks on your country? We've seen that growing during the Gaza conflict when some GCC countries opposed U.S. policy on what's happening in Gaza. What are they supposed to do but obey?
I think what they are seeing is that these U.S. sanctions and arm-twisting approaches are just not as decisive as was generally considered even a year or two or three ago. After all, what was going to, quote, defeat Russia? This was taking Russia out of the SWIFT banking system. This was the Western sanctions that were going to be put on. Now, of course, it failed utterly and completely. This is part of the point of the BRICS. The BRICS countries are now 36% of world output compared to 29% of the G7. We're in a different age. Yes, threats can be made, but I don't think that they can be decisive. I think if the rest of the world is calm and cool, and not divided relentlessly, as the U.S. tries to do, because that, after all, is the basic strategy of empire, is a divide et impera, divide and conquer. If the rest of the world is stable, careful, I would say very prudent and professional in its statecraft and diplomacy, these threats are just not so powerful. They're illegal in international law. They really twist international institutions out of shape, and which don't want to be twisted out of shape. So I think that there's actually real opportunity here for progress, even with the United States not cooperating. One of the things that will move the two-state solution to really being implemented is the unity of the Arab countries. They've been very, very clear in Riyadh last November, in Bahrain in May. The Bahrain Declaration is superb. It lays out what needs to be done. The King of Bahrain has further consulted, of course, with President Putin, with President Xi Jinping. This is what the world wants. It wants diplomacy. It wants a systematic approach. It doesn't want the United States saying to one Arab country, come on our side, we'll give you some goodies, but break with the rest. It doesn't want that. And this kind of unity will prevail.
One state solution is more talked about amongst Palestinian resistance groups, it has to be said. And are you really saying to me that...
Let me just say a word about that, if I may. There is an overwhelming worldwide consensus that we need two states for two people right now. And there is absolutely a one-state solution top of mind among both sides of this conflict. And that is the path to continued war. And the world, whether it's China or Russia or Brazil or India Or even in its mumbling way, the United States, but it vetoes all practical approaches so far, says, look, we've got to settle this on the basis of the international law dating back to 1947, actually, and 1967, and endless discussions. So that's the worldwide view. The United States has blocked it repeatedly on Israel's behalf. The Israeli government definitely wants a one-state solution. They call it Greater Israel. They don't disagree with the one-state solution.
I didn't mean that kind of one-state, obviously, Professor.
I know, but I'm telling you that if we're going to have peace, it's going to be peace on the basis of what the world says we need to stop the deaths, the killing, the suffering, which is horrendous, which is genocidal. It needs to stop.
Yeah, you remarked recently on the fact that the Emir of Bahrain went to Moscow and then Beijing. And we know that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is refusing to cut oil production on the orders of the United States ahead of a November election and so forth. Has the United States really run out of threats then against these GCC countries that are clearly for very different policies as regards Gaza? The UAE, of course, was holding a rotating pen. The UN Security Council kept on trying to put forward resolutions. The United States is going to just give up on threatening GCC countries? They can rest easy? Or are we, in this region, going to expect further threats? And, I mean, not sanctions. It can be reputational damage in media.
Look, my own view of this is that since 1915... the Arab world has been manipulated repeatedly. It has been manipulated by the McMahon letters of Britain promising an Arab state after the end of World War I. It was manipulated in the Sykes-Picot Treaty. It was manipulated in the Balfour Declaration, which was contradictory to those first two initiatives. In other words, Britain was what an empire is. It was utterly deceitful and arrogant, and it imposed, together with France and America's acquiescence, a Versailles settlement that meant 100 years plus of manipulation of the Arab world. Everybody knows this. This is a long, sad story of outside manipulation. My own view, for whatever it's worth, is that this era of manipulation can come to an end. It comes to an end by unity. Because the U.S., if it's dealing with one particular country, it'll have a lot of power. If it's dealing with the 22 members of the Arab League, much less. If it's dealing with the 57 countries of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, virtually none. These threats don't count unless those who are threatened allow themselves to be divided and manipulated by an outside threat. I think the world's changing. I think the idea that one country, whether it was Britain up to 1945 or the United States afterwards, can make its own rules, threaten others, manipulate international organizations, manipulate the international payment system. I think that this era is really at an end and that we are entering a multipolar world. But it's very dangerous, this moment.
Well, let's just finally look at the danger. Let's just, without an INF treaty, as we know, what did you make then of the United States, the Biden administration, changing policy, saying that their weapons that they're sending, like Britain did a while back, and France and Germany, they can target Russia directly, and the United States now saying the Azov battalion, you might have to describe whether they are Nazi inclined, because you're banned from saying Nazi inclined if you're in Britain. What do you make of these announcements of being able to target Russia directly, of arming the Azov battalion as a Russian warship docks in Havana with hypersonic missiles?
Look, first of all, the loser of all of this is the Ukrainian people. Perhaps 500,000 deaths of Ukrainians to this point, a devastation of so much of Ukraine. This is largely at the behest of the United States, because when an agreement between Russia and Ukraine was tentatively reached in Ankara in March 2022, based on one principle that will end this war, Ukraine's neutrality, the U.S. swooped in, Boris Johnson swooped in, said, don't take it, you'll win. Well, this was a terrible, terrible piece of advice, but it was also a dreadful, awful miscalculation.
Sorry to interrupt, just very briefly. 600,000 killed, hundreds of thousands killed because of that?
Several hundred thousand more deaths in Ukraine of Ukrainians because of that decision, without question. Of course, it's an utter tragedy. Ukraine is often losing more than 1,000 people to dead and wounded every day right now on the battlefield. Russia's military superiority in the air and artillery is very clear. It's the U.S. that keeps pushing them to fight to the last Ukrainian, as that dreadful, ironic phrase puts it. But there's accuracy to it. It's the U.S. No, take our arms. Keep fighting. Keep dying. Instead of negotiating a basic point. Neutrality, a space between the U.S.-led military alliance and Russia. Just a space. This isn't rocket science. This is a basic idea of statecraft that goes back more than 2,000 years. Leave a little space in between the major powers and there can be peace.
And so as regards this targeting of Russia?
Well, everything is an escalation right now because I think, among other things we know in American history, don't lose before an election. So Biden has an election coming up in November, and they don't want to see something like we saw in Afghanistan in 2021, another doomed U.S. Misadventure that dated 40 years, by the way. Long story, different one. But in any event, they don't want to see that before November. So they keep the escalatory path, which is extraordinarily dangerous and extraordinarily reckless. We should be pretty peeved about it because it's putting the whole world at risk.
Professor Jeffrey Sachs, thank you.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
That's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those bereaved by UK-US EU armed genocide. We'll be back on Monday with the Electronic Intifada's Ali Abu Nima to break down false narratives about Israel's genocide in NATO mainstream media. Until then, keep in touch via social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Monday.